From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
And this morning we kick off with writer Caroline Paul, who combines scientific research, cultural studies, medicine, psychology, and memoir to uncover the science and the psychology that shows how outdoor adventure may be the single best solution for a healthy brain, a vital body, a confident mindset, and a longer, happier life as we age. And then we speak with venture capitalist turned Buddhist and executive coach, Jerry Colonna. He joins to talk about his new book and radical self-inquiry. The book is called Reunion, Leadership and the Longing to Belong. Our next guest is New York Times bestselling author Caroline Paul. She has been an outdoor adventurer her whole life. And in her new book, she combines scientific research, cultural studies, medicine, psychology, and memoir. She uncovers the science and the psychology that shows how outdoor adventure may be the single best solution for a healthy brain, a vital body, a confident mindset, and a longer, happier life as we age. Her new book is called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. Caroline Paul, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you as a means to reinforce the message that I think a lot of us here in the Park City area try to drive home to ourselves on a daily basis, is like, get out there and get after it as we age. Give us your background.
In terms of my whole life, I've always been someone who goes outside, and I have sort of led what people consider is an adventurous life. But as I was reaching, I was around 55, and I was looking around and I saw that there weren't really any women my age out there with me, either on the waves when I surfed, and I'm not a good surfer. A lot of women are much better than me. I'm a very good paddler. I've learned to paddle for my life, but I didn't understand why there weren't women out there. And when I skateboarded, I saw nobody my age, no women my age. I saw men my age, maybe. And when I fly also experimental planes, and again, hardly any women at all. And so I began to wonder, I've been an adventurer, as they say, my whole life, sort of a jack of all trades when it comes to adventure, not really an expert at anything, but trying to find my way outside in many different ways. And I started to wonder, maybe as I'm reaching 60, I should change, because is there something that people know that I don't? And that sort of began my quest for and I wrote my book.
I don't know. It's both very freeing to be in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and still be pursuing outdoor sports or just being outdoors or having adventures, because you don't have any expectations of yourself necessarily, or you have adapted your expectation. I'm wondering if that's why you might think that a lot of women drop out of that, is because they still have the same expectation as before, instead of saying, it's okay if I don't surf the big waves or whatever it might be. What do you think about that?
I don't want to make like sweeping pronouncements, but then again, I did write a book that made sweeping pronouncements. I feel actually pretty more certain that that's maybe why men pull back. But I wrote this book specifically for women. There is a lot that men can get out of this book for sure. But I really started it intrigued by, I guess intrigued is not quite the right word. I was a little appalled really at the mindset that I saw my friends had about aging. They really were galled at their advancing years. And I myself was actually kind of psyched. I was curious, who was I going to be? What was it going to be like? I did also realize that there was a lot of messaging that was actually quite toxic about women as we age. Now, I know men get messaging too about aging, but I just don't think it's not the same. The messages they get, they still have Indiana Jones running through the tombs and Harrison Ford is like 75. And we don't get those kind of, vital heroes. And you'll, if you speak to, you know, women of a certain age, sort of certainly after 50, but even after 40, women say they start feeling invisible. So I was intrigued by this messaging that basically tells us we are, you know, getting frail cognitively, on a decline, certainly culturally irrelevant. This idea that women feel invisible is really, is everywhere at after a certain age. So that's what I started with. And I found a lot of research that says, you know, the way we look at our aging predicts how we're going to age. And I had a feeling that outdoor adventure would offer us a sort of antidote to that. And that really is where I start the book.
So let's stay on that topic a little bit. You know, I think we've all seen it. I mean, we're all north of 50. And when do you feel like this cultural change like happened? I mean, I feel like in the 50s, 60s, 70s that, you know, it was easier to stay engaged and to be like, there was more of like a work culture with men and women, you know, it didn't really matter. So, I mean, is there scientific data around that when it changed? Is it from the media?
Yeah, I have to push back on that. I think that back in the 1950s, we aged a lot earlier. I think that, you know, culturally, women actually were maybe invisible, or at least sort of invisible in a lot of spaces. And also people of color were invisible. And so I think that now what we're feeling is, you know, I think it's things have gotten better, but ageism has not. It's probably one of the things, and a lot of it is because we as women also think, you know, it's not just men projecting this or young people or the media. We think it of ourselves. We think that we're on a physical decline and that we should probably pull back.
So what are your strategies for keeping a positive kind of mindset around this, the aging? I mean, I know there are strategies we all probably employ on a day-to-day basis.
I think that the thing about negative messaging is that it's so implicit and it's so insidious. It's very hard to just have like a mantra about how vital and brave we are as you know, as we approach 60 and how fun and relevant we are. So it was really more about, I realized that my positive attitude about my aging, my deep sense that aging was going to be a time of exploration, really came from my own mother. She was almost my own subliminal messaging because I saw her blossom at 40 after she divorced my dad and sort of found a new life and was happy. And then 50 and then 60 when she found of all things, bicycling. So in some ways, she became my own sort of cultural message that I was getting every day about how great aging was going to be. And I think that's what we need. And that's why I'm urging people who don't, like your audience has an outdoor background, but there's so many people who don't, like my mother, who did not have an outdoor adventure background at all when she picked up a bicycle. And to go outside and treat it like something as important as like your daily pharmaceuticals, whatever you take, because you're aging.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Caroline Paul. She's a best-selling author and the author of a new book called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. I love that you brought up the subject of your mother having found biking, and where we live, it's a huge mountain biking mecca, biking in general. But what we have seen, love it or hate it, but the onset of electric bikes, e-bikes, have really inspired a whole generation of people, I think, probably a lot like your mom, who have said, well, you know, I'm of this point in my life where I don't want to get on a mountain bike and go up a 9% grade, but wow, that e-bike sure is wonderful to ride around town. And these kinds of things are inspirational. So if we draw a parallel between like the e-bike and how that inspires people, you know, what are some of these other types of inspirations that you bring up in your book?
Well, first of all, I recently did an e-bike trip through three European countries, and it was so fun because I've been clear for a while that, I think there are four pillars of healthy aging. I think we all would agree that you need community, you need health, you need a purpose, and you need novelty. And finally, you need this positive mindset for women because otherwise, the things you do are just going to be seen through the prism of how bad aging is. But health, I often get my exercise just in a gym. But it turns out that just being outside is so medicinal in itself. And they've done a lot of studies on just the well-being aspects of things like bird song or tree chemicals, or simply the rounded lines of nature as opposed to the hard lines of urban architecture. All very good for our brain, all very good for our emotional well-being, and all very good. Clearly, if you're outside, you're usually doing something movement-oriented, so very good for our physical health. And so that's the first thing, just to get outside. So if you're on an e-bike, I think it's awesome. I own an e-bike. I love it. It helps me get outside. And so I realized when I first started this book, frankly, that I was going to be looking at a wide range of outdoor, quote, outdoor adventure. I mean, I'm somebody who, I will step off a cliff with basically a bed sheet on my back. I was a paraglider for many years, but not everybody wants to do that. And so I decided that I was going to sort of give a nod to some of these outdoor activities as if they were adventures. And so I went bird watching. I went simply walking outside and boogie boarding. And I have to say that while I was, first of all, very surprised at this new information I was getting about how incredible it was just to be outside, I also realized that these things are adventures too, because adventure is really about the attributes that it triggers inside you as opposed to the actual activity. So people are not going to want to fly a gyrocopter like I do, and I get it. But definitely things like bird watching have all the rhythms of adventure. There's this quest, exhilaration, exploration, definitely physical health. When I went bird watching with Virginia Rose, who is founder of Birdability, and she's in a wheelchair. And Birdability is to bring people out who are in have disabilities, specifically wheelchairs initially, but then she herself realized the wide range of people who had disabilities who would benefit from being outside. So she founded Birdability, and we walked for 6 miles or wheeled, depending on your situation. It was very physically vital. And so I really, during the course of this book, broadened my definition of adventure. And initially, I was a little disingenuous. I went with a little bit of a little bit of a snooty attitude about what adventure was, and I changed my mind. So there's a lot of different ways to get outside and have this beneficial adventure feeling.
I was sort of the same way with something like golf. Like I said to myself that, golf is not something I do. Well, I'm learning to golf right now, and I'm having so much fun with it. And I think as well, I can adapt it to what I think would be my expectation for myself, which is to walk the nine holes or whatever it is instead of taking a golf cart. And that's, you do have a chapter in your book called, what is it, adaptation or adapt?
Adapt, yeah.
Adapt. And so could you talk about does adapting look?
Yeah, a lot of these women, first of all, a lot of them did not have an outdoor life before they picked up whatever they were doing. And they but they and they learned, but the women who did learn to modify what they were doing. I spoke to a woman named Cynthia Hicks, who had cancer in her 60s. And she had been like a skydiver in her 20s. And then she was a hiker and a camper with her family and all during her family life. But when she got cancer, she started not feeling as well. And she said that she started to pull back. She stopped scuba diving. She pulled back on her snowboarding. And I kept asking her, did that bother you? Did that bother you? And she's like, No, you know, I had 30 years of that. I'm so grateful. She was one of the most, she had the most gratitude of anybody almost that I've ever met. Everything she was just really grateful for. Until when I met her, she was simply, she was still embracing the adventurous spirit. But what she was doing was when she traveled, she would type in something fun to do here. And then she would, something would pop up. And she would look at it and she would often go and do it if it suited her. And so she had bungee jumped this way. And when the reason I met her is because I saw her wing walking on a video when she was 71. So, I mean, she, you know, that doesn't sound like an adaptation for a lot of people, but she had had this whole adventurous life. And now she was just finding that adventure in sort of smaller day, sort of day things.
Well, we're lucky here in Park City, I feel, because we can walk out our door and pretty much hit a trail or jump on our bike in our garage and take off. And you talk a lot about community. And I think that's, as I age, I think a lot about that. Well, what if we moved somewhere else and did something new? How would we find our tribe? Are there strategies for that? I mean, besides just throwing everything to the wayside and jumping in with both feet that you've found at work.
Frankly, the community aspect was one of the other surprises that I encountered on this quest. I think I had really underestimated how community is so well, so important as we age because it falls away often. We become more and more isolated. But I had definitely underestimated how it benefited us and how it was just an integral part of outdoor adventure. So I went and I interviewed the oldest BMX biker in the female biker in the country. She was 74. And BMX biking I was interested in because it was looked like a competitive sport. So I also interviewed a triathlete. And both of them, well, the triathlete had actually, she had purposely decided she was going to do everything on her own. She'd never run before, so she got an app called Couch to 5K and she started running, which initially it promised to like get you running and 3 months, and instead it took her, I don't know, half a year, but she did it all on her own. But then she finally joined a group, mostly because she wanted to start racing. And suddenly this whole world opened up to her. She was still individually running, but because there were other people at the races, or that she was running with, she was training with, there was, she suddenly realized like how that spirit was so vital to her, just her life. Probably improved her running too. And similarly with Miss Kitty, who was the BMX bike racer, that's also an individual sport. But the community around the track was incredible. So I myself embark on a lot of things on my own. Like I learned to, you know, ride a one wheel on my own, which is an electric skateboard, or I learned to fly on my own. But once there, your life opens up socially in ways that I think I had underappreciated.
That's why I think we ride bikes is most of it's in a group. So, and you find a lot of inspiration and camaraderie with that group. I feel like you run across people that are aging or in your same age group, and you have, I feel like, a couple of different groups. The ones who are taking aging by the horns. Like I'm gonna keep going until I'm dead. We can sleep when we're dead, kind of approach versus here we are today in this society and we have all this great medicine. And it's like there was a shift at some point, and I feel like it correlates with like plastic surgery, better medicine. And it's like, I can just take these pills and I can go, I can fix my turkey gizzard and I can just fix it all. How do I inspire new people to move? Is it innate in some people that aging isn't a thing? What's the scientific data behind that? I'm so curious.
Well, I mean, I think the scientific, yes, of course, there are super agers, but I really think that's not even that important because I think we all can change our mind about it, and it's vital that we do, given the science that shows that if you have a negative view of your own aging, you will have a bad aging experience. You will have cardiac incidents earlier. You will have cognitive decline earlier. And conversely, if you have a positive view of your aging, you are healthier much longer and you live 7.5 years longer. And I assume that's a much healthier years. So this is vital that we all embrace sort of a positive view on aging. And again, the question is, especially for women, given how negative it is that we hear, the negative messages we do hear about aging, how do you do that? And I think just taking that step outside and embracing an activity is the sort of catch. It's the one thing I think that covers all the bases of healthy aging and that will you know, put us on par with those super agers, frankly.
Yes. Caroline, I'm wondering, you know, also as we age, the learn something new idea is, it's very good for even staving off things like Alzheimer's, for example. But in your chapter about that, it's the part of your book that's on the brain and learning something new. Tell us a few stories about people that you came across that you interviewed who started something completely new, like wing walking.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I asked a lot of people, like, when was the last time you learned something new? And you know, most people our age and younger, actually, we don't learn something new. We think by this age that we've figured out what we like and we just kind of stick to that. But, you know, I think as we all know, the brain is really plastic. And one of the best ways to keep it really healthy is to trigger it with novelty. So I wanted to talk to people who are learning something in the outdoors. And I came across Vijaya Srivastava, who had, again, no outdoor experience at all. I mean, she said she'd done badminton when she was growing up in India, but now she was in California and she still didn't even go on walks. And she, her doctor said, you know, some of your sort of physiological numbers need to change, glucose, blood pressure. Why you need to pick up some exercise. And Vijaya said, well, okay. And what should I do? And she said, well, the doctor said, you have a pool at your condominium complex. Perhaps you should swim. And she said, I don't know how to swim. And the doctor said, prescribe lessons. And Vijaya is the kind of person who, even though she'd had no background in the outdoors or any real physical activity, is really fun and charismatic. And she had seen kids, by the way, swimming in that pool and having a lot of fun. And I think that also kind of launched in her mind. And she thought, okay, well, I guess I'll try to learn to swim at 68. And she asked a friend, which I think was very key to that journey, because I think otherwise she might have dropped out. And together they learned to swim. And the thing that triggered, of course, was probably incredible new neural connections, which happens in our brain no matter how old we are. It's not true that our brain stops growing, because we continually make brain cells and we continue to lay down new neural pathways. And so she did that, but not only that, what she ended up doing was upending her own sense of herself and started doing all these other activities, which I think was one of the most incredible outcomes of learning something new. She just went on to start busting other, borders of her knowledge. It was, she took up yoga, she walked in the California hills, people told her she looked more confident, she stood taller. It was pretty great to talk to her and swim with her, frankly.
What a great story. And there are these stories and many more in your new book, Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. Our guest is Caroline Paul. Caroline, thank you for writing this book. It's so great.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't think there's anything else like it, this idea that outdoor adventure can be the sort of one pill maybe we should all take as we age.
Right. Definitely speaks to both of us. Wait, before we let you go, I have to ask you, what is wing walking?
Yeah, I know. It's thank you. People did not know. I knew because I'm a pilot. It's from the barnstorming days in the 1920s. They did a lot of these things on biplanes. They did all this low flight, and people would, you know, transfer from one plane to another in midair, or from a car on the ground while it was driving. A plane would come and they would get on the wing. There were all these aerobatics that in these barnstorming shows. But I think they crashed just one too many times. And once you couldn't do low flight like that, you couldn't really see people on a wing. So that sort of faded. But there is one place in the United States that does teach wing walking. And when I heard that Cynthia had done this, I was definitely not going to do it until she told me, well, you wouldn't believe the courage that you get from climbing up on a wing. And I thought, oh, God, now I have to go do it for the book, because courage. Darn it, because I'm a pilot. I don't want to get out of a perfectly good cockpit. And that's what it is. You get out of a perfectly good cockpit at 3,000 feet in the air and climb on the wing and then attach yourself to the king post. And then the pilot does loops, barrel rolls, and hammerheads. And anyway, but yes, and you do... it was interesting because the instructor, you take sort of a day of classes and then you do your wing walk in the end of the day. And she assured me, oh, no, don't worry. You know, I know it's 3,000 feet, but your muscle memory, if you just keep doing it, this isn't about being courageous. This isn't about, all this is about teaching your muscles to do something. And I promise you, they will do it. And sure enough, they did.
That's so great. Well, thanks again for joining us. This is a great book.
Thank you so much. Thank you both.
When was the last time you did a little radical self-inquiry? When was the last time you really examined your own leadership? And how do you get to a sense of belonging? Well, these are questions that our next guest will help us wade through in the next half hour and also in his new book called Reunion. Our guest is former venture capitalist turned Buddhist and co-founder and CEO of Reboot. It's an executive coaching and leadership development company. And he's the host of the Reboot podcast and author of this new book, Reunion, Leadership and the Longing to Belong. We're so happy to be joined by Jerry Colonna. Jerry, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I have to say that I enjoyed that introduction because I like how being a Buddhist gets positioned in opposition to a venture capitalist. So you've got it. You understand both professions.
Well, that's probably a good segue into my question, which is something Jay and I were talking about before we came on air was, you know, when you see that someone is an executive leadership coach, it sounds pretty intense. And I have to say that when I opened up the question as to who is Jerry Colonna, I found a much different person than the one that I thought I was going to get. That's a two thumbs up thing.
Oh, I'm smiling ear to ear on that one because I like breaking type, let's put it that way. But what was it about the venture capitalist description? Because that's true. I was a successful venture capitalist for 15 years. What was it that sort of struck you?
Well, I think a venture capitalist, I mean, I think of this, and it's a stereotype in my head, does not present like a very mild-mannered, soft-spoken person, that it's maybe a more focused, intense, and singular inquiry into how to do business.
Yeah, and how to make a profit, how to turn a dollar into two. We were joking before we started recording that I'm from Brooklyn, so I enjoy people perceiving me as mild-mannered. Don't piss me off. I think that juxtaposition, Lynn, makes sense. And I think what, you know, in a broader picture, what you're identifying is that our typical understanding of, say, business leadership is that it's divorced, if you will, from the heart. One can argue that even political leadership is divorced from the heart. One can argue that leadership or power can be divorced from the heart. And perhaps I'll answer an implicit question, which is, how does one go from, say, hard-nosed venture capitalist to Buddhist life and executive coach? And my honest answer is through a broken heart, because I was 38 and the whole Megillah, the whole house of cards that I had built that was externally focused and performative collapsed. And instead of, I had kind of three choices. One is suck it up, to use a gendered phrase, man up, which those who identify as men might recognize hearing that language. Or I could have sucked it in and slowly killed myself. Think about the prevalence of depression in ages 35 to 60. Or do what I did, which was stop, sit still, get my butt on a meditation cushion, and figure out these bigger questions. And I thank the good Lord every day that I chose the last path.
I love where this book, what I've learned in kind of researching where you are. I mean, the one that really bounced out, and I think it's relevant to what we were just talking about, is the better humans equal better leaders. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that it's about in a lot of what you do. But I think one thing that jumped out on that is leaders dedicate themselves to creating systems of belonging. Mm-hmm. And I think what jumped out to me is that learned, a shift you have to consciously make, or is it innate to some people, you know? And I'd like to know more about that, if you could elaborate. I think the systems of belonging is a big theme for you. So a couple questions there, but.
Yeah, so I want to acknowledge that is as much an aspiration about leadership as it is an observation. And what I'm trying to do with making that link is call forth a transformation of what we define as leadership from power over, from the amassing of wealth, from the extraction of natural resources and labor, into something much larger, something that is actually systemically beneficial. So the observation, better humans make better leaders, it's kind of obvious when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
And you sort of pause, and then what I like to do, being a little cheeky, is ask, so why do we have such difficult leadership? Why do we have such terrible leadership? And I think that the reason is actually quite simple, because the better part of what I'm talking about, the better human part, requires us to use radical self-inquiry, which is a term I coined to try to figure out what I'm doing with this psychologically bent Buddhist insight inquiry, to use that process to close the wounds of our childhood. Because in my observation, most of what we define as toxic leadership stems from the incomplete maturation of people who hold power. And because they're incomplete, they hurt people all around them. And so if we sort of take a step back and link it back to belonging, if we look at the root wounds that almost universally we experience, it's because one of three, if not all three, wishes from our childhood are missed. We want to be loved, and we want to love. We want to feel safe physically, emotionally, spiritually, existentially. And when we want to know down to our bones that we belong. And when we miss those things, as my teacher and friend Parker Palmer likes to say, violence is what we do when we don't know what to do with suffering. And you think about the loss of love, safety, and belonging as a root of suffering. Then you give that character power and you let them loose. And so what I'm trying to do is make this connection between the work that I think is so important, the work that I outlined in my first book, Reboot, Leadership and the Art of Growing Up, and this second book, which is a call to action, which is to say, what if we transform the definition of good leadership from the amassing of wealth into systemic belonging or creating systemic belonging?
So staying along the lines of this, so I mean, we've all had, I mean, I've had wonderful leadership and mentors where it just seemed like it was so simple for them. And then have unfortunately had the worst half of that.
Right.
I mean, again, I want to know the good ones. Is that just, again, is it innate? Is it natural? Do they not have to work at it? Or, you know, are they working at it? We just don't know it. I mean, because I love what your book stands for. I mean, I see, but that's a kind of a, like one thing that just popped into my head as I was reading through things here.
I really love your question, Jay, because behind it all is a kind of hope, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the hope is that there are folks who are either innately or nurtured in such a way that they produce a sense of calmness and systemic belonging, to use that term, in those around them. And ultimately, the reason I called the book Reunion and not Union is that there's an implicit hope in that as well. There is a fundamental belief that we can get back to a time where better humans are leading us. We can get back to a time where the better angels of our nature draw us together. The short answer to your question is yes, there are people who are innately, I'm not so sure what innately means in that regard. I mean, I don't know if it's the DNA protoplasm that says, okay. But I think that there are people who inherently have that. And one of the things that gives me hope on a daily basis is a Buddhist concept of, you know, the technical term is Buddha nature, but the less technical term is basic goodness. And it simply says that human beings are basically good. And that what actually blocks us, what obscures us from acting well, is our disconnection from each other, is our attachment to the things that actually generate suffering. And again, that's a very hopeful message. So I think I would not do the work that I do, which is about transformation and people being able to connect back into their better nature, if I did not fundamentally believe, and after 25 years of doing this work, fundamentally witness those transformations to people, to use the cheeky term, to people actually growing up. And least anybody get confused, I have to grow up every day myself.
It's never too late.
Not only is it never too late, it's never done. It's a practice. It's not a one and done, you know?
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with executive coach Jerry Colonna, who's written a new book called Reunion, Leadership and the Longing to Belong. Well, if good humans equal good leaders, I always wonder this, how is it that people rise to such positions of power who are not good humans? Mm. I always think somewhere along the way, they're going to get caught and they're going to fall. But it seems in modern day here, we have liars and criminals and frauds
and narcissists. Yeah.
At the very top.
So there's a complex, I think there's a complex reason behind your observation, Lynn. excuse me, and it has to do with projection. Because we ourselves, those who are in a position being led, are unsettled in our own worthiness. Because we question whether or not we're worthy of love, safety, and belonging, we are susceptible to the con man. We're susceptible to someone who promises us, I have all the answers. And we can take a sidebar and go all the way into politics, but let's just pause and say, this is not limited to politics. It may be the most obvious in politics right now, but this happens in business all the time. In fact, even venture capitalists, people who write checks to support the establishment of businesses, are just as susceptible to this. In fact, we love funding the extreme narcissist because they promise us magic. They promise us a shortcut to doing the hard work. And so we project onto that leader the best of ourselves. And then we vote. Just like narcissists, we fall into the pond having fallen in love with the image of ourselves. And so then we vote against our best interests time and time again.
It's so interesting that you bring up the example of venture capitalists falling for the fraudulent. And it makes me think, you know, first, the first name that pops into my head is Elizabeth Holmes. And it made me wonder, how could so many people who are so well-versed and experienced and successful in business have fallen for her? And I'm forgetting what the name of her business was.
Theranos.
Theranos, yes. And that's the example, right?
Because they promise. They promise magic. And in this case, they promise 100 times return on your money without work. Okay? I mean, look, from Greek mythology to Mark Twain, we have been taught, our elders have taught us time and time again to beware the snake oil salesman. And the snake oil salesmen succeed. Because, you know, the phrase I use is better humans make better leaders. There's a subtle piece of that, which isn't just about the singular person. It's about us as people. See, if I do my work to take back my projections, if I do my work to take back my shadow, to use a Jungian term, then I'm less likely to be bamboozled. I'm more likely to ask the tougher questions about what is in fact going on. But here again, doing that requires me confronting the parts of me that I don't really want to confront. We all have a stake in doing this work. Because if we don't, to take it into the political realm for a moment, our children suffer.
So you say that leaders are complicit in benefiting from leadership styles many would like to change. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about here, I believe. Can you give some examples of that?
The first thing I would say, Jay, is that in my first book, Reboot, the core question that I asked is internally focused. How have I been complicit, not responsible, complicit? Have I helped it along in creating the conditions in my life I say I don't want? Now, that's a call to action to take responsibility for your own interior work. In the new book, I transform that question a little bit more outwardly. And I first do the work with myself. How have I been complicit and benefited from, say, white supremacy or patriarchy? Hey, newsflash, I am a white, straight, cisgender male of power and privilege. Should I deny that reality? The first thing I have to do is I have to acknowledge that I have benefited from that. Not that I have actively, individually participated in something, but to pretend that that is not true does a disservice to the people who have actually borne the labors and the burden of systemic oppression. So that's step one. Step two is to really unpack. I give an example in the book. One of the seminal moments in my life was when I was a freshman in college and I couldn't pay my college tuition, and my white, straight, cisgender professor awarded me a scholarship. Now, thank the Lord he did, because it set me on the course for the rest of my life. But I will never know if that scholarship would have gone to someone who identified differently than me. And I'm not feeling guilty about that, because guilt will trap me in a rumination. I want to be curious about that. I want to be open to that possibility. And I want a world that I may never see, which is a world of systemic belonging.
So is that the radical self-inquiry that you, is that kind of encapsulates that, it seems to me? Is that a correct assumption?
I think that's right. I think that to look with your own life with curiosity, not to seek blame, not to shame, but to lift up the possibility of transformation and change. James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be transformed, but nothing can be transformed until it's faced.
The sense of belonging we have somehow, somewhere in this world, or maybe just in this country, really lost a sense of belonging. And it's given rise to some strange things that people have done to feel that sense of belonging. How did we lose it, do you think, Jerry?
It's a great question. And here's a question that's a corollary to that. Who benefits, and who benefited from that loss? Because if you really, and this might be the VC brain in me doing a due diligence, but if you really want to understand why things are the way they are, who benefits from our bizarre obsession around the Second Amendment? Who benefits from this deep and profound fear of migrants and immigrants? Who benefits when I know in my own life, growing up in Brooklyn, I know with the benefit of hindsight that banks and real estate agents benefited from redlining and blockbusting. I know that people literally made money by stoking fears of folks, of black folks moving into white neighborhoods. So, you know, that's a little psychotherapeutic flip, but laying on an entire community, right? If you are on a couch with a psychoanalyst, one of the things the psychoanalyst will ask you to consider when you reveal a pattern, what is the benefit to you to maintaining that pattern? What is the benefit to us as a society, to us being at each other's throats, to lay out something disturbing? What is the benefit to us when children are killed? That's a disturbing question.
These are such important questions that you pose in your book, and I love the way that so much of what you do is put into question form that helps us do our own self-inquiry.
The you got
book
it.
Is Reunion, Leadership and the Longing to Belong. Our guest is Jerry Colonna. You can also find him at reboot.io or the Reboot podcast. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me. It was a delightful conversation. Thank you for asking such thoughtful and meaningful questions. As someone who's trying to make a difference, to be received with powerful questions and thoughtful questions it's really, really life affirming. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry.
And again, that was Jerry Colonna. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.